studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Tuesday, September 1st, 2015. On today's show, Dr. Deborah Budding joins us to discuss why there are so many kids diagnosed with ADHD. It's part of our series on the science of health. And what's behind all the Asian bashing in the presidential election? Vincent Pan will explain. Plus, we'll explore the forgotten history of black domestic workers organizing for their rights with historian and author Premila Nadasan. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Robert Jensen. He's an author and a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Sonali.
Kim Davis, a clerk in Rowan County, Kentucky, has refused to issue marriage licenses to gay couples in defiance of the U.S. Supreme Court. The court ruled early this morning that she had no legal standing to refuse licenses. In fact, the day after the Supreme Court ruled in favor of gay marriage this summer, Ms. Davis began refusing to issue any licenses, claiming her religious faith was being violated. Among the couples who tried for the fourth time to get a license issued and were denied was David Moore and his fiancé David Ermold. The two have refused to leave the courthouse until they can get a license. It remains to be seen what action will now be taken against Ms. Davis. Well, Bob, if she refuses to do her job after being told by the nation's highest court that she has no right to refuse, doesn't that simply mean she should be fired?
It's exactly what it means. It's called contempt of court, and for a public employee to be in contempt of court, of course, there's no justification for it. It's a little odd to say, as Kim Davis is saying, I have a constitutional right to deny you your constitutional rights. I'm still trying to parse that one. But if you look at her statements, she says she's doing this under the authority of God. And, you know, as a person who teaches First Amendment law, I'm pretty sure that the First Amendment prohibits the establishment of a state religion. So this one seems pretty cut and dry.
And speaking of religion, Pope Francis has said that women who have had abortions and show contrition can be forgiven by the Catholic Church. The Pope will grant that right to priests starting in December, but will only be valid for a year, the so-called Holy Year of Mercy. Traditionally, women who have had abortions can be excommunicated from the Catholic Church. However, most Catholics support both abortion and birth control. A global poll conducted last year found that 65% of Catholics worldwide support the right to an abortion, and 78% support contraception. Catholic women are even more likely to get abortions than non-Catholics. In a statement issued today, the Vatican said, quote, forgiveness of the sin of abortion does not condone abortion nor minimize its grave effects. The newness is clearly Pope Francis's pastoral approach. Many bishops have granted priests permission to forgive the sin. The fact that this statement is coming from the Pope and in such a moving pastoral way is more evidence of the great pastoral approach and concern of Pope Francis. Well, Bob, what do you make of this? And by the way, what does the word pastoral really mean? The Pope hasn't exactly been supportive of the right to an abortion in the past, has he?
Well, you know, there are always two reactions I have to these kind of stories. One is to recognize that the question of abortion is morally complex. I have friends, Catholic pacifists from the anti-war movement, who believe in the so-called seamless garment idea of respecting life, and I can understand that. But I think part of the reason this is always so contentious is the most clear defense of a woman's right to choose an abortion is a feminist defense. It has to do with the structure of patriarchy, with male power. And what's at the heart of patriarchy in the modern West? Well, the Catholic Church is right there at the center. So this is one that, although Pope Francis is moving to a more progressive theology on a number of questions, this is one where I think it's going to be hard to overcome the deep patriarchal structure of the Catholic Church. I'm interested to see how he tries to play it, but I'm not expecting much on this, quite frankly.
And finally, tensions remain high in Houston, Texas, after the killing of a white police officer named Darren Goforth. 30-year-old African-American suspect Shannon J. Miles appeared in court today, accused of the execution-style murder. Harris County Sheriff Ron Hickman said at a press conference, quote, we've heard Black Lives Matter, all lives matter. Well, cops' lives matter, too. At any point where the rhetoric ramps up to the point where calculated, cold-blooded assassination of police officers happens, this rhetoric has gotten out of control, end of quote. And in Minnesota, there has been a similar pushback from police over the Black Lives Matter slogan. After hundreds of activists marched at the state fair carrying banners and criticizing the police, Police in the Twin Cities have been involved in a number of shootings of unarmed African Americans. BLM organizer Rashad Turner told the press, quote, "We want police officers to face the same treatment that we face as civilians for killing officers." Meanwhile, in Pasadena, California, this week, Black Lives Matter organizers are reporting that Pasadena police arrested a 10-year-old activist named DeMarcus Farley during a protest, and we'll report more on that story as details emerge. Well, Bob, what do you make of police feeling that the slogan Black Lives Matter threatens them and endangers them?
Well, the slogan Black Lives Matter, of course, isn't a threat to anybody. The slogan that was chanted at the Minnesota State Fair was, to say the least, politically rather tone deaf, referring to cops as pigs in a blanket and frying them. But the threat to cops right now, I think, is really the request that we're all making, that police reflect on the culture of policing and the role of police in enforcing a very unequal distribution of wealth in this country. And I can understand why police don't want to reflect on either of those questions, but that's the demand, and that's the demand we should be pressing. Cops are going to try and get out of it, out of that self-reflection, just like people in positions of some power and authority tend to want to avoid self-reflection. As a tenured professor, I'm well aware of how people in positions of privilege tend to avoid it, but that's the demand, and that's where we have to keep pressing.
Thanks, as always, Bob, for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Sonali.
Robert Jensen is our daily News Flash guest expert. He's an author and a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's the diagnosis that most parents dread. Your child has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. Today, increasing numbers of parents are facing the prospect of dealing with developmental diagnoses such as ADHD, administering drugs like Ritalin or Adderall, and whether or not they decide to medicate their kids, of helping them manage educational and social expectations. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that in 2003, 7.8% of 4 to 17-year-olds had been diagnosed with ADHD. 4 years later, it was 9.5%. In 2011, that number jumped to 11% of school-aged children. There is ongoing debate about what is behind these increasing rates and whether it's simply a matter of overdiagnosis, misdiagnosis, or the global push for academic performance. Joining me to help navigate that debate as part of our series on the science of health is Dr. Deborah Budding. She is a board-certified neuropsychologist who works with children, adolescents, and adults in the greater Los Angeles area. She's co-authored multiple publications emphasizing habit formation and non-conscious subcortical brain contributions to function. She's a supervising faculty member at Harbor UCLA's neuropsychology training program. Welcome to Uprising, Dr. Budding.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So let me just jump right into it. There is a school of thought, particularly as you go into the alternative health circles, that ADHD is entirely made up, that it's simply a disorder that doesn't exist, and it's all just society's expectations on kids that kids can't live up to. Is ADHD an actual disorder that needs treatment?
I would say most people who have been diagnosed with ADHD would absolutely say it's very real. Mm-hmm. But it is a culturally, to some degree, when somebody's diagnosed with it, it's culturally determined what is a maladaptive behavior, for example. But it's absolutely real.
And so when you say it's a real disorder, what does that actually mean? Because, you know, when you have cancer, you have cancer. When you're pregnant, you're pregnant. There are no two ways about it. But when we talk about neuropsychology, It can be a little fluid.
It can, which I think is one of the things that makes it so difficult, that One of the challenges we have in the mental health field is that the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that people use to make these diagnoses, is behavior-based. It's not directly linked to the brain. And so when you're dealing with a neurodevelopmental disorder, my colleagues and I who do, we're called theory and practice. We do trainings together. One of the things we talk about is the idea of if water is not coming out of a hose, is the problem at the end of the hose? You're looking at systems. Right. Okay, so there are lots of different ways that a behavior or a set of behaviors happen from a brain perspective and from a body perspective. And it's not like there's one thing that causes ADHD. It's a multi-determined, it's a multi-determined diagnosis. And no two people really who are diagnosed with ADHD are exactly the same either. So it can be a cause of confusion, I think, for a number of parents. And also, ADHD is sort of a misnomer in a sense that Martha Denkla is a researcher who basically came up with the saying that it's really more of a disorder of intention. So it really should be called intention deficit disorder, because the real challenges of ADHD are a person's ability to form and then implement intentions and to interact with their environment in a way that's effective and can meet the demands of the environment.
So how do you explain the increasing rates of ADHD that we see? I cited a number of statistics, and you know, by medical standards, these are huge jumps in diagnoses.
You know, I think people come at this question from a lot of different directions. One is certainly there's a very strong genetic component to ADHD. For information about this, I'm a huge fan of science Twitter. So Kevin Mitchell does, he's at Wiring the Brain, very knowledgeable on genetics, and I recommend checking out his work for information on that. I would say, in my position, I don't see a lot of kids who don't have ADHD being misdiagnosed. Sometimes I see people who have a lot of comorbidity, which means multiple diagnoses. So you can have anxiety, and you can have ADHD, and you can have other things. I do think that there needs to be care and caution and a great deal of thoughtfulness when you make diagnoses. So,
and you think that there is not as much care and caution these days, or is it hard to tell?
I don't know. It's hard to tell because so many different people can make a diagnosis of ADHD. So
right, it's not just one kind of doctor. Or
exactly,
one kind of,
exactly. And there can be differences in training in terms of what people emphasize, etc.
Which is part of the problem, I think, and also part of the public confusion over this.
I agree. That's one reason why actually my colleagues and I are going to be doing some web-based programming on neurodevelopmental disorders and trying to help people understand them both from a neuropsychological and current neuroscience perspective, but also from a kind of a more neurodiverse view as well.
And what about the efficacy of drugs like Ritalin and Adderall for those who really struggle with the disorder? Are those drugs actually helpful?
Well, I mean, I don't prescribe, so I can't really say. But I have certainly in my practice and with people I know seen properly prescribed stimulant medications really be lifesavers for people. So I think...
And does it go the other way too?
The opposite of a lifesaver, I've never actually seen that.
We hear anecdotal evidence of kids who have been diagnosed with Ritalin and Adderall, et cetera, whose sort of personality gets deadened.
Yes, and that's not something that's not okay. That's not how it's supposed to work. So one of the reasons I like doing very comprehensive, very persnickety kinds of evaluations is to help people who do prescribe make useful choices and to make sure that, stimulant medications really only work for a percentage of people who are diagnosed with ADHD, and they can be very effective with certain kinds of disinhibition, right? But, for example, inattentive ADHD or kind of sluggish cognitive tempo, that's a subset of ADHD that sometimes responds to stimulants, sometimes doesn't respond to stimulants. But when they work, they can work quite well and can make the difference for a student really, really struggling and doing fantastic.
So let me get real personal here, something I hadn't really intended on doing, but I think it really does matter to bring up, for example, a parent's perspective. My own son was diagnosed with ADHD, which I utterly don't believe. And I basically said to myself, I would do anything before I medicate him. That would be the last thing I do. And he's doing fine. You know what I mean? He needed to emotionally mature, and he's doing great. And I find the expert opinion that was given to diagnose him as being full of crap.
I have to say, I see a lot of people who come into my office who supposedly have ADHD, and they leave understanding that they don't. So that attention isn't one thing. And I think that's something that gets lost. A lot of things can cause problems with attention. And sometimes, anxiety in particular can have a huge impact on attention.
So kids who are socially anxious about being in social situations.
Right. Yeah. And impulsivity is not all the same either. There's the, again, you can describe problems with attention being due to your sort of emotional system figuring out what in the environment is worthy of attention, okay?
Right.
And so one of the jokes that we have is that ADHD is more that nothing is interesting enough to keep your attention, and it's sort of the oh shiny, right? But on anxiety side, everything kind of has an equal valence, and it becomes very difficult to determine what merits attention because everything is equally scary or equally concerning. And so that's a whole other kind of attention problem, and it's very real as well.
On the first that you mentioned, how much of or how much do you think our current model of education has to do with how children might be reacting in their environment and being diagnosed? Because if things aren't holding their attention, maybe the model of schooling itself is problematic. We know more and more these days that that scientists are realizing kids need to get up and move. They need to move and move and move.
Yes.
Whereas in conventional schools, we sit them down at desks, and they, you know, at least for large chunks of time, cannot move. And that can drive a kid crazy.
Yeah, well, it drives me crazy. this sort of gets to my colleague's basic approach is very sensory motor based. It's much more about sensory motor development and movement and the importance of movement to development. I'm a big fan of Daniel Wolpert's work, and he has usually when I'm giving talks to large audiences, I play a small clip of his The Real Reason for Brains, where he talks about why we have a brain. And his idea, and this is not just his idea, it's a lot of people's, is the idea that we have a brain so that we can voluntarily control movement. That if you don't need to move, you don't need to have a brain.
And this is part of sort of how our brains evolve.
Exactly.
So the idea is that our brains didn't necessarily evolve to rationalize and think and, design large buildings, but to move, to physically be able to move ourselves from one place to another?
Well, yes, because, again, we're either doing something or we're thinking about doing something or we're regretting something we did, right? So everything that we do in life is really about doing things. And so thought is, one way of considering thought is that it's offline movement, and we're planning movement. We're learning from our experiences, okay? So when we're asking children to sit for long periods of time and engage with only one portion of themselves, I think that's asking a bit too much. And actually, one of the things I recommend for kids who have ADHD, and for kids who don't, for that matter, is a tremendous amount of physical movement. And for kids who have ADHD, to have a period of very intensive aerobic exercise before beginning school is very helpful. And there's actually some schools in the area that have the potential for students to do that before they try to sit down.
Or even designing classrooms where you're not sitting in one place looking at a blackboard and one or whiteboard on one end of the classroom.
Yes, and more engaged. I like those big bouncy balls. I like sitting on those. They're good for core development. Although some kids end up kicking them around the room.
So. Isn't managing or helping children manage societies and educational institutions' expectations of them, isn't it better for us to design our systems to help kids manage them without the use of drugs?
See, I don't really see it as either or, because for a lot of people, if one of the main issues for their particular ADHD presentation is disinhibition, that is very hard to manage without any kind of medicine at all. But it's also not magical pixie dust. And I tell this to parents all the time. If your child or if you are somebody who will benefit from some kind of stimulant medication, you still have to learn to manage yourself. You still have to, it's also not an excuse. When I'm meeting with children and with teachers sometimes, I'll talk about the fact that I'm horrifically nearsighted. And I can't just decide not to wear my glasses when I'm driving my car, because if the police officer pulled me over, I can't say, "Officer, I couldn't see the stop sign, I'm nearsighted," right? He'd say, "Why aren't you wearing your glasses?" Right. So I really like to have people respect their neurologies, essentially.
Does this, the line of inquiry about how our brains evolved to make us, look at our movement to rather than be designed to help us think, does this have an implication on autism spectrum disorders as well? I know that that's an area that you work on as well.
And I wouldn't say it's an either or. I mean, I think thinking's important. I mean, I prefer to be able to think. I think most people do.
Some of us make our living through just thinking, sitting on a chair and thinking.
Exactly. But yes, this is also relevant for autism spectrum disorders, and I'm fairly passionate about autism spectrum disorders and about neurodiversity. And in this community as well, I don't like taking this disease approach to autism. At the same time, I think it disrespects people with disabilities to not acknowledge that there are differences that are disabling. Although disability is contextual, so in certain circumstances, whether you are disabled or not, to some degree, depends on what the environment is asking you to do and whether you're able to do it.
I think that what you just said is such a crucial issue that doesn't often come up when we think about these kinds of quote-unquote diseases.
Yes. I tend to, with neurodevelopmental disorders, I tend not to take so much a disease approach, although certain diseases such as epilepsy, et cetera, do have psychiatric diagnoses that go along with them. But again, that's why with neurodevelopmental issues, it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. And it does take a certain degree of subtlety. But I also think it also just takes basic respect and caring for people.
Which we don't have enough of in our society.
On
that note, I want to thank you so much for this very nuanced discussion of ADHD. Thank you so much, Dr. Deborah
Budding. My pleasure.
My guest is Dr. Deborah Budding. She is a board-certified neuropsychologist who works with children, adolescents, and adults in the greater Los Angeles area. And her website, where you can find out more about her work, is DeborahBudding, that's with two Ds, .com. If you missed that, just check our website, uprisingwithsonali.com. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. There's been a lot of racism against Latinos during this presidential election campaign, most of it from Donald Trump. And then last week, the focus of the hate abruptly turned to Asians. And it didn't come only from Trump, but from Jeb Bush, the most pro-immigrant candidate in the crowded Republican field. At an event last Monday, Mr. Bush was asked about the offensive term, anchor babies.
The term anchor babies could affect your ability to win the Hispanic vote.
Look, as I said in Spanish, my background, my life, the fact that I'm immersed in the immigrant experience, this is ludicrous for the Clinton campaign and others to suggest that somehow I'm using a derogatory term. What I was talking about was the specific case of fraud being committed where there's organized efforts, and frankly, it's more related to Asian people coming into our country, having children, in that organized efforts, taking advantage of a noble concept with his birthright citizenship.
Mr. Trump then lashed out on Twitter. Later in the week, Bush was asked to explain why he accused Asians of having so-called anchor babies.
I was wondering if you regret your use of the term anchor babies and your scapegoating of the Asian immigrant community yesterday and your explanation for the use of that term.
So, look, my record is pretty clear. I'm married to a Mexican-American, United States citizen. I'm immersed in the culture. I'm bilingual. I feel like I'm bicultural. I'm proud of the diversity of my own family. And my record, not just yesterday, but over my lifetime, is one that people can look at. I was talking about a very narrow-casted system of fraud where people are bringing pregnant women in to have babies to get birthright citizenship. I support birthright citizenship, by the way. I support it. I think that is a noble thing that we should do. But we've got to control the immigration system in this country. We have to control our borders. We have to deal with the fraud. We have to deal with the visa overstayers. 40% of people that come to this country come with a legal visa and they just stay. They immerse themselves into the community. If we're serious about being a country of immigrants, then we need to enforce the laws so that legal immigration is respected and illegal immigration is not easier than legal immigration. So I appreciate the comment, but I'm 62 years old. When I was 17 years old, I fell in love with Columba Garnica de Bush, and it's going to be really hard for me to get lectured to by anybody about the politics of immigration.
Joining me now to discuss what is behind the Asian bashing in the election is Vincent Pan. He's Executive Director of Asian Americans for Civil Rights and Equality and Chinese for Affirmative Action. Welcome to Uprising, Vincent.
Good morning.
Now, can you explain where the term anchor babies, quote unquote, came from and why it's so offensive?
Well, it's actually been around for a while. And I think more recently, it started to emerge really as a way of suggesting that Latino immigrants were coming to the United States to have children who then would gain American citizenship, and that would essentially anchor them and anchor their family to be able to stay in this country. I think that what Bush is referring to here is oftentimes a practice that's described as birth tourism. And so I think the two different issues often get conflated, mm-hmm. But they're really part and parcel as the same type of fear-mongering, essentially suggesting that people who come to the United States from non-white countries are somehow doing so to take advantage of the American system, that somehow are more dishonest or not to be trusted in ways that other ways of immigration from European countries have not been subjected to.
And actually, Vincent, on this issue of an undocumented person having a child in the United States, even if that child obviously through our birthright citizenship gets citizenship, and then if they turn around and, you know, years later, because as babies, they can't very well file legal paperwork, years later, file any legal paperwork to sponsor their parents. Even that method, even that path for parents to get legalization is extremely long and extremely arduous, isn't it?
That's right. You know, and so I think that one of the things that's happening here is that, you know, presidential candidates in as campaign season that's really grounded in fear and loathing, are trying to find isolated anecdotes, stories that somehow suggest that there's something insidious going on, this so-called invasion of immigrants that that Bobby Jindal has described. And so, like, in reality, the numbers that we're talking about here are very, very small. And at the same time, the process is very, very difficult. So to somehow suggest that the path towards being able to live a life with some dignity and respect for undocumented immigrants is somehow easy I think is absurd.
And where do you think it came from that Jeb Bush, when confronted about his use of the term anchor babies, backtracked so clumsily, you know, essentially saying, wait, I love Latinos. I'm married to a Mexican woman. I speak Spanish. I'm immersed in the culture. It's actually those Asians over there.
Yeah.
And this do you think that was sort of out of the blue that he didn't even realize he was going to say it and now he's kind of stuck?
Well, I do think that he was trying to refer to you know, something different that's happening, which is, you know, in some parts of California and Los Angeles, there have been these so-called, you know, birth motels. Again, very, very small numbers of people who've been, you know, implicated in this birth tourism. You know, I think he pivoted to that in part because he is trying to appeal to a slightly more diverse base than Donald Trump. So on the one hand, to defend against accusations of racism against Latinos, he very quickly moved to scapegoat Asians. I think what Donald Trump is doing is actually something very different. And I think by attacking, you know, birthright citizenship, by attacking, you know, the very large, not only immigrant community, but the Mexican, not just the undocumented immigrant community, but the entire Mexican American community, I think is sort of even broader swipe and slur.
Now, even on this issue of birth tourism that Jeb Bush was trying to refer to, and there was some news, there was some news coverage of this practice, it's actually technically not illegal unless the person who's having a child in the United States overstays their visa to do so. So women who are pregnant, and many of them might be basically trying to work around China's one-child rule, would come to the U.S. They're not crossing a border without papers. They're flying in through an international airport with a visa and paying somebody to take care of them while they have their child here. And then they can go back with their child because China allows them to have a second child. This is actually wealthy Chinese folks, mostly.
Yeah. That's right. There's nothing illegal about the practice. You know, the children are returning with the parents back to China. It's something that oftentimes occurs between mainland China and Hong Kong for you know, the reasons you cited in terms of navigating the one-child policy, but also sometimes I think concerns about the quality of healthcare that people can receive. But I think that it takes on this very different tone and it's used to incite fear and bigotry and this sense of difference. And I think that's the underlying sort of current in so much of what we're seeing in the Republican primary, that they continue to look for different groups to blame, and that's what binds them together.
Now, let's talk about the anti-Asian rhetoric specifically as it should be viewed through the lens of history, because, of course, the U.S. has a long history of hateful rhetoric and actions. Do Bush and Trump play up the so-called yellow peril fears with their language?
Well, they do. I don't think it's something that is new to them. You know, we see this going back, you know, throughout the history of presidential campaigns. I think there may have been a slight cooling off period where it was somehow less fashionable for some of the Republicans to be so overt about it. And I think what we're seeing now is, especially with Donald Trump, just this sort of unabashed revelry and celebrating the idea that some parts of the United States want to be sort of tougher, not just against immigrants and Asian American immigrants, but against Asia in general. Mm-hmm. And so there is this link between denigrating and raising xenophobic fears against immigration, but you also see it in the way they talk about foreign policy and trade policy, too.
So let's actually play the clip of Donald Trump's comments that came after Jeb Bush's. This is what he said last week.
I mean, you know, negotiating with Japan, negotiating with China, when these people walk in the room, they don't say, Oh, hello, how's the weather? It's so beautiful outside, isn't it lovely? How are the Yankees doing? Oh, they're doing wonderful, great. They say, we want deal. He'd jump out of the seat.
Now, do you find that offensive, what he said, the way he said it, we want deal?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think what he's doing is caricaturizing an entire, group of people. In hearing, he's clearly going for a laugh. So, and he gets it. He gets it from his audience. I think the idea that people from Asia are again somehow tougher negotiators or not as truthful in their business dealings is part of an ongoing stereotype. And one that it does affect Americans of Asian descent here in this country.
Now, will these comments coming from these Republican candidates, you think, change the dynamics of the race very much? I mean, are any portions of Asians going to defect from the GOP towards the Democrats because of Jeb Bush and Donald Trump's comments?
I think so. I mean, so many members of the Asian American community are either new voters, first-time voters. And presidential races are oftentimes the first introduction to the different political parties. And I think that when you see this, and maybe you're not as well read on specific policies, but you see this playing out in broader media, it does, I think, impact one's perception. That being said, over the last few decades, the numbers of Asian Americans who have voted for the Republicans has been declining. And I think the support for the Democratic candidate probably peaked with Obama's election and re-election, and now we're starting to see it level off a little bit. Because, there's clearly plenty of racism and homophobia, misogyny within Asian communities as well. Hmm. But when they see, when community members see the way that it's celebrated against our community members, I do think it gives people pause.
How important, finally, is it, Vincent, for communities like Latinos and Asians to come together around political issues? It's essentially these sorts of elections can get so ugly. Donald Trump just released a Willie Horton-style ad against Jeb Bush over the last 24 hours. And it's that divisiveness that can be easily sown between communities is something that presidential candidates love to play up.
Well, I think that it's not only important, I think it's critical. And for political reasons, but also for ethical reasons. I think that politically, along with African Americans, Asians and Latinos do comprise, the new majority. The new majority here in California and what will be the new majority in the United States. And I think it becomes incumbent upon us then ethically to develop a politic that is inclusive, that is fair, that is compassionate. And so even if it takes some sense of defending or protecting ourselves against bigotry to bring people together, it ought to lead us to a politics that is aspirational as well, so that it isn't just pushing back against the racism and the misogyny, the homophobia that we see coming from some of these Republican candidates, but to actually foster something that is values-based and inclusive. Mm-hmm.
And Asians are currently the fastest-growing immigrant group in the country, even more than Latinos, although in absolute numbers, Latinos are still a bigger group. Vincent, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Give out a website that listeners and viewers can get more information.
Sure. People can visit Chinese for Affirmative Action at caasf.org and Asian Americans for Civil Rights and Equality, which is a broader network, at aacre.org.
And we'll post those to our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, later today. Thanks so much, Vincent.
Thank you.
Vincent Pan is the executive director of Asian Americans for Civil Rights and Equality and also with Chinese for Affirmative Action. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Thank you. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The 1960s were a time of intense political activity and organizing in the U.S., but not everyone has received their fair share of attention or had their history documented. In a new book, academic and historian Pramila Nadesan covers the forgotten history of activism of African-American domestic workers from the 1950s through the 1970s. Often left out by organized labor, Black women working as nannies, house cleaners, and more took matters into their own hands and established an identity as a labor force. In her book, Household Workers Unite, the untold story of African-American women who built a movement, Nadesan profiles many of the leaders and members of this movement to give them their rightful place in the labor history of the U.S. Pramila Nadesan is an associate professor of history at Barnard College at Columbia University, and her earlier book was entitled Welfare Warriors, the Welfare Rights Movement in the United States. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Now, you invoked in your book the film The Help to illustrate how Black domestic workers have traditionally been seen as without agency, you know, until they were sort of sparked by outsiders. How prevalent is this myth today, and how wrong is it?
I think the myth is very prevalent today, and we can open up a newspaper on any given day and read stories about domestic workers who've been essentially imprisoned in their homes, who've been mistreated. Some of these workers are undocumented, some are not, but they're relatively powerless compared to their employers. And so I think those stories of vulnerability, those stories of disempowerment, really dominate the discourse about household workers. And it's one that was also very much a part of the novel and the book, The Help, where domestic workers were clearly exploited and mistreated, but the ultimate exposure of their story came from a white protagonist, a young white woman who decided to put their stories down on paper. And the domestic workers themselves in that story are really in the background. And it's interesting because in my historical research in the archives, I found quite the opposite was true, that domestic workers in the 1960s were very active and were mobilized and were organizing.
And so let's talk about a very important aspect of civil rights history from which we don't really hear much about domestic workers, and that's the Montgomery bus boycott. You write about one of the many women leaders, Georgia Gilmore, who founded the Club from Nowhere. How important were domestic workers in the Montgomery bus boycott, and where did a woman like Georgia Gilmore find her place there?
Domestic workers were really the mass base of the Montgomery bus boycott. When we think about that boycott, it lasted for a year, for one full year. Most of the people who rode the buses were household workers who were going to and from their places of employment. People like Martin Luther King obviously were the leaders of the boycott, but the boycott would have never been successful, as Georgia Gilmore tells us and her story tells us, would have never been successful had the domestic workers not decided to support the boycott and organize one another. And Georgia Gilmore had been a household worker living in Montgomery for many decades. She had had her own run-ins on the buses and had gotten fed up with her mistreatment on the city buses. And so what she decided to do was to organize other household workers in support of the cause. They baked cookies, they baked pies, they cooked chicken dinners, and they sold these door to door as a way to raise money for the boycott. And so I think it was both her leadership in mobilizing other women, as well as the ways in which they actually concretely supported the boycott through raising money, that ultimately made the boycott a success.
And at that time, was the identity of domestic workers even really a clear one, that that their labor was it even seen as formal labor that deserved its place alongside other labor?
It was not. Most of the labor rights that we take for granted today, whether it's minimum wage legislation or Social Security or unemployment insurance, most of that legislation was passed in the 1930s during the Great Depression. And there were several categories of workers that were excluded from those labor protections. Domestic workers were one, and agricultural workers were another. So because of that, domestic workers were really outside the margins of labor. They were outside the margins of labor rights, and had been excluded from some of the most important protections. So they were working without federal minimum wage protection. They were working without the right to Social Security prior to 1950, and without the right to unemployment compensation in most parts of the country. There were some state-based laws that did apply to them. So because of that, this work was devalued and was not recognized the same as other kinds of work.
And I want to get to how that began to change. But we talked about Montgomery, Alabama. There was also, of course, Atlanta, Georgia, another very important center of civil rights organizing. And you profile a woman named Dorothy Golden, who was a seasoned organizer. In fact, she helped the late Julian Bond with his congressional campaign. Who was Dorothy Golden? How important was she?
Dorothy Golden was a resident of Atlanta. She was extremely important.
I should say, not Golden, I'm sorry.
And she got her start in the civil rights movement in Atlanta, worked with Julian Bond, worked with a student nonviolent coordinating committee. She was a confidant of Martin Luther King. And she organized against school segregation, but ultimately went on to organize household workers. And she was one of those community leaders, one of those women who knew Atlanta very well, who knew everyone in Atlanta. And so her organizing was really part of the base for the eventual development of a national organization of household workers that developed in 1971 and had a membership of about 25,000 women across the country.
There was also in Cleveland, Ohio, Geraldine Roberts, who was a part of the Domestic Workers of America. Is that the organization you were mentioning?
Yes. Well, no.
This is a different one.
This is a different one. The Domestic Workers of America, although it sounds like a national organization, was a local Cleveland-based organization. The national organization was called the Household Technicians of America, and Bolden's organization in Atlanta, as well as Robert's organization in Cleveland, were both members of that national organization.
And so these women in who were a part of this very important workforce organizing in various cities were coming together in national coalitions. How were they interacting with the civil rights struggle? How did the so-called politics of respectability get in the way?
The civil rights movement was really premised on this notion of a kind of formal equality and the ways in which African Americans should be entitled, of course, to attend schools that were set, that were integrated, to sit at lunch counters equally with white Americans, all of which, of course, is extremely important. But for household workers, I think their struggle was much broader. Their struggle was not only about the dismantling of Jim Crow legislation. Their struggle was also about respect on the job. Their struggle was about economic justice. Their struggle was about the right to be able to raise their own families in decency and with dignity. And for them, that meant sometimes having to speak up and having to be militant. Household workers, because of the way they were marginalized, both in the civil rights movement as well as in the labor movement, I think needed to speak up forcefully about the value of their labor and about making a claim for their rights. And they did so, and they did so frequently, and they did so without apology.
There were also two women in New York City who you profiled, Geraldine Miller and Carolyn Reed, with the Professional Household Workers Union, an organization that was, I understand, short-lived. How did you document the histories of these women? Where is this history? Was it a matter of going to the public record and collecting it all? Was it a combination of that plus first-person interviews?
It was a combination of several things. Unfortunately, most of the women had passed away by the time I decided to start writing this book. But fortunately, there were other historians who documented their stories. So there are a number of oral histories that I looked at quite carefully. I also looked at their own personal papers and their writings that had been saved. One of the goals of my book was to think about the stories these women told. So storytelling is a key theme that I look at. And I want to look at the stories that they told partly as a way to think about how they understood the occupation, how they understood their vision for the future, about what their lives would look like. And it's fascinating to me because they used storytelling really as a way to build a political community, as a way to build identity. So when they talked about their employers, when they talked about the history of domestic work in their families, the work that their mothers did and their grandmothers did, that became the kind of way to connect with other household workers who had similar experiences. And it also, I think, gave them a way to think about how to reform the occupation.
And so even so then would you say that this form of activism, storytelling as a form of activism, then actually helped document and leave behind enough memory that someone like you could come along and weave it into a story?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the stories that these women told over and over again was the story of the Bronx slave market. And these were street corners where African-American women gathered during the Great Depression, and they would wait for employers to come by and hire them for a day's work. These were notorious sites where African-American women were exploited, were often not paid properly. And as Geraldine Miller from New York said, she had been told stories of the slave market, and what she was told is that employers would come by and look for the women with the most scarred knees. Because women with the most scarred knees were the women who scrubbed floors down on their hands and knees.
Wow.
And Miller told this story partly as a way to tell other household workers, we will not scrub floors down on our hands and knees any longer. So it was interesting the way she used history and the history of exploitation as a way to think about reforming the occupation.
So how did eventually household workers, domestic workers, get their rights at a federal level? You talked earlier about how they'd been left out of federal minimum wage laws. What part did the women that you profile play in getting their work acknowledged and recognized, and even just getting Social Security benefits?
Well, they got Social Security earlier, and that was the result of a group of middle-class labor feminists. So they did win Social Security in 1950. Their struggle was primarily around the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the federal legislation that guarantees workers the right to minimum wage. And as I mentioned, household workers had been excluded from that. So these women who organized were responsible for the passage of legislation in 1974, amendments to the Fair Labor Standard Act, that then included household workers. And it was an interesting struggle because what they did is they developed an alliance primarily with their employers, with middle-class women who were hiring household workers. So there were a number of feminists in the 1960s and the 1970s. Gloria Steinem was one of them. The National Organization for Women was a strong advocate of household workers. And middle-class employers and household workers themselves testified before Congress about the value of household labor. And I think one of the ways that this alliance was built is how both household workers, as well as middle-class women who did household work for free, essentially, they weren't paid for it, began to talk about the ways in which this work, regardless of whether it is paid work or unpaid work, was devalued and needed to be revalued. And so that was really the basis of their alliance, and they were successful in that in 1974.
Finally, Pramila, what do you hope this history that you've put down will be taken as? How do you hope it will be used? Because as I'd mentioned earlier, and of course the reason why you wrote the book is because this history is not one that has really been treated as a legitimate labor history and a history around racial justice, economic justice, and women's rights.
Yes, I think, this history has a lot of lessons for rethinking the 1960s, for rethinking the role of African-American women, especially poor African-American women, in the civil rights movement. I also think it offers lessons for contemporary labor organizers. domestic workers were experiencing very precarious labor conditions in the 1960s and the 1970s. That is, they were working intermittently. They were working for multiple employers. They weren't guaranteed basic labor rights. And those conditions that they worked under, I think, are increasingly coming to resemble what most workers today are experiencing. So if we think about Uber drivers, or if we think about adjunct professors, or if we think about the large number of people who are doing consulting work today, or who are subcontracted workers, they aren't guaranteed that basic labor legislation that we think of as a basic right for Americans. And so I think the question is, how do you begin to mobilize and organize this workforce? And I think the history of domestic worker organizing can offer some lessons for us about how to do that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll post details about your book at our website. Any websites you'd like to give out?
My website is PremilaNadasen.com.
And that's PremilaNadasen.com. We'll post a link at our website, uprisingwithsonali.com. Thank you so much. Best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
My guest is Premila Nadasen. She is an associate professor of history at Barnard College at Columbia University. And her book that we've been discussing is called Household Workers Unite, The Untold Story of African-American Women Who Built a Movement. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Jonathan Alexander. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Follow us on facebook.com/uprisingradio and on twitter.com/uprisingradio. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.